The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The Biden administration says North Korea is testing a new intercontinental ballistic missile system that's based on data from two recent launches that American intelligence agencies are assessing. And those two launches, the White House sees as a serious escalation, according to senior administration officials. These officials say North Korea appears to still be testing the system because the most recent launches did not show the range or capability of prior launches. But these officials say they could in the near future. The Treasury Department is expected to slap new sanctions on Pyongyang tomorrow in response. President Biden is willing to meet Kim Jong-un with no preconditions if staff-level talks reach an agreement, according to these officials, though there was no word on when that could happen.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon. It's good to be here with you today. Thanks for joining me. That news from last week, fired the wrong button here, but if you're wondering what happened, of course, I'll leave it at that. I mean, you know the news. I mean, yeah, I won't regurgitate what we talked about last week. Good to be with you here today. Boy, it's a crazy day for me. It's been super busy. There's a lot of news going on. We got a lot to get into with you today, and I hope you'll be able to hang out with me for at least the next 3 hours. One of the things I really want to dive into today, too, as well as the news that I'm going to get you plugged into, is really Our Lady's role, what we're seeing here spiritually unfold in Ukraine. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Our Lady of Kazan. Vladimir Putin seemed to have an affinity for that. I'll tell you about that. I'll tell you what the papal nuncio to Ukraine is saying. We'll take a look at whether or not St. Andrew the Apostle erected a cross in Kyiv. And if I have time, maybe I'll get you plugged into the Seven Sorrows. I've been worrying about it. But if you're battling cancer too, a little later, I want to share with you what Padre Pio did when confronted with a health challenge. So we have that and a whole lot more to get into today. I want to thank you for being here with me. And of course, we'll pray the chaplet in about an hour, so be sure and join us. some news that is both good and bad. First, let me start with what's happening in our country, and I'll tell you about something else that's happening to our neighbors to the south. If you live in the state of Colorado, it's a kind of a sad day there. Abortion is still available, but Colorado's House, they just passed a bill over the weekend to make abortion a fundamental right. That's right. The bill passed after a heroic effort by some House Republicans there to persuade their Democrat colleagues not to pass it, but the Republicans, you know, they kept up a debate. I think it was 24 hours straight they were going at this, but it was really to no avail, and the bill denies the right to life to any, and I quote, okay, just listen to how serious this, any fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus. That's what they put in the law, and it prohibits local authorities from passing any kind of restrictions on abortion. So the bill now goes to the Senate. It's expected to pass. It's also expected that the governor there is going to sign it. So it's not law yet. It's a call for us to pray, a call for us to be aware of what's happening in our country. Because I think when we go down this path, and I say this a million times, I'm going to reiterate it probably another million, abortion, the fruit of abortion is nuclear war. Those aren't my words. That was Mother Teresa. And when we as states, when we as a citizenry allow, when we deny the right to life, the most fundamental right, you know, to life. And again, a quote, fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus. When we go that extreme, there's consequences for that. Our founding fathers understood that the citizens of this country have an inalienable right to life, to liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I think we need to get our focus right, right? Just because the child's not outside the womb, it's denied that fundamental right. It's tragic. Good news, though, on the other side, right? Maybe we can learn from our brothers and sisters in Mexico. Several Mexican states have legalized abortion, right? We've talked about that in the past. Here's the thing. The Mexican diocese, and I think this is what happened. I think all this is rooted in the spiritual. When we look at war and the cause of it, when we look at abortion and the culture of death, when we look at the attack on marriage and sexuality, I think it's all rooted in the spiritual. Mexico made a terrible mistake. You know, they went down the same path as America and a lot of other countries. They legalized abortion, and in response to that happening, the Mexican diocese, I don't know, I forget the name of the actual diocese there that did it, but they came out and they told their politicians who voted in favor of legalizing it, you're banned from receiving communion. You are banned from receiving communion. And people might say, that's horrible. You're using this as a political tool. How can you do that? You know, the Eucharist should never be used. Garbage. Baloney. You know what? You're not in communion with what the church teaches when you pass legislation that says you can destroy human life. I mean, go through your commandments, right? Thou shalt not kill. It couldn't get more simple. It couldn't be more simple than that. That's just my perspective here. People can argue it. They can debate the issue. To me, it's one of the great tragedies that we are experiencing today. But I say bravo to you. I am so proud of the bishops down there. And I think we here in America should be doing the same thing. I think we should say to Joe Biden, I know this is divisive and I probably shouldn't be talking about it. No, I think he's so wrong personally. You know, and Nancy Pelosi, and we can go through a whole litany of other Catholic politicians, and there's many of them, who put their faith and moral teaching aside because they want votes. They want to kowtow to their party and to its political ideology at the cost of human life. I think, look, if you really love God and you love your faith, then you need to be in communion with it if you want to receive our Lord truly present in the Blessed Sacrament. Otherwise, you're eating condemnation. Otherwise, you know, you are profaning. You are committing sacrilege, in my opinion. So the bishop says, no communion for you. You can't act as godparents either. So the priest in charge of the diocese family life office, he told the news agency down there that this ban is merely, and he says, I quote, the recognition of the objectively unworthy state of a person to receive the body of Christ. And look, I'm not just throwing stones at politicians. It goes for any of us that are in mortal sin, right? If you are fornicating, cohabitating in an immoral way, if you're doing things that violate, that are of serious sin, you shouldn't be receiving the Eucharist. You shouldn't be receiving it. So I commend the bishops for what they've done. Pray for them. Hey, following the news over in Ukraine, a lot happened over the weekend. I'm sure you're up to speed on what's happening. Russian leaders apparently don't care about unborn life over there, right? That bombing of the maternity ward. Remember that horrible attack on Mariupol? Remember that iconic photo? You had this woman on a stretcher being carried out by four or five rescue workers. She was pregnant, made their way through the rubble. And the world saw this, and they thought, enough's enough. I mean, this is a war crime for Vladimir Putin to attack a maternity ward. This is horrible, right? That image, really, it was, I think it pierced the heart of the world. I mean, people were outraged by it. Well, the Associated Press today, here's a quick update for you on that. They learned today that both the woman and her baby are dead. They've died. They did not survive that accident. Her pelvis apparently was crushed and her hip detached. Can you imagine the pain this woman was in? You know, she had this baby in her. So doctors delivered her baby by C-section, but there were no signs of life. And then the woman herself, she died on the operating table. So AP hasn't been able to identify her yet, but I would ask you to pray for her soul. And when you see these stories, just let's pray for an end to this war. Let's pray for peace. We have to pray for peace. I've been doing it a lot. I mean, again, I was awakened. I don't even know what time it was. I didn't even look at it. It was the middle of the night. It was dark. And then I prayed a chaplet of divine mercy that very moment for all those who are dying, especially those in Ukraine. And I prayed in particular, just for peace. There was a report from a very famous apparition that the Virgin Mary appeared to these seers recently with her arms outstretched. She prayed for a very long time for peace, very, very long time. And we're invited to do the same thing. So she died, this pregnant woman and her child. So did a journalist. I don't know if you heard this as well. Apparently, an American journalist named Brent Renaud, he was freelancing. He had written for the New York Times, and he was killed by Russian troops after passing through a Ukrainian checkpoint. He was a filmmaker, a journalist, and here's what CBS was reporting a little bit earlier about this case.
Today, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky visited soldiers at this hospital in the capital as Russian forces advance on the city. And among the war's casualties, American journalist Brent Renaud, who was killed when Russian troops opened fire on his vehicle near Kyiv. It's been 18 days now since Russian tanks rolled across Ukraine's border and airstrikes started pummeling cities and civilians.
You know what a Ukrainian police officer on the scene when this guy died, he told a PBS correspondent, I think it was Jane Ferguson, he says, tell America and tell the world what they did to a journalist. You know, Maggie and I played for you the other day audio of a group of British journalists who came under fire, four or five of them. They took bullets in an attempt to get out and try to save their lives. So it is a war zone. And it's a dangerous place to be, especially to report. One final bit of news here, then I'll give you a quick update. Russian President Vladimir Putin is trying to keep the Russian people from finding out what's going on here. And this is part of the problem. I think if they had the true information, they would know. He's taken extraordinary measures to do that. There are people around the world who are trying to get around those measures. And one group has obtained millions of Russian phone numbers. And this is such a cool story. And what they're doing is they're randomly calling these people to tell them what's happening. Because the media in Russia is totally biased. It has shut down, it's threatened journalists 15 years of prison for reporting news that they didn't they didn't think was true, a false narrative. This is a special military operation. It's not a war. We're not attacking civilians. And the world sees what's true, but the Russian people don't. Many Russians don't even believe when their relatives are sending them photos or telling them what's happening because of what state media is telling them. That's the power of media to influence the mind. I'm always struck by that. So it's not an easy task. There's another group based in Poland who's got tens of millions of cell phone numbers, more than 100 million email addresses, and they set up a website where people can send text and emails to these people, and there are also some preset messages in Russian. It's called Squad 303. I'll tell you more about that coming up, but that, to me, is an absolute new development in the face of warfare. You know, talk about dropping flyers from airplanes, pamphlets. Today we're using email and cell phone numbers. I think it's great. I hope it opens the eyes of the Russian people. The horrors that Russia is inflicting continue, though. Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president there, he's called repeatedly for a no-fly zone over the country, a request that the U.S. and NATO, they've rejected because they're concerned about where it will lead. They do not want to get into a third world war, and they've come out with that. They said, look, we're trying to avert a war, not start a larger one. And when you're dealing with a nuclear-armed nation like Russia, it's not a pleasant prospect to think about, and Vladimir Putin has given veiled threats, of course. Estonia's parliament, which is a NATO member, has become the first NATO ally actually to call for that no-fly zone. In fact, they've asked for all UN member states to set it up. That would be a major development if that was to take place. And then finally, the U.S. and its allies, as you know, they've imposed these massive economic sanctions on Russia. Although with the Iran deal, it almost seems like President Biden wants to give Iran a workaround on that. Russia is fighting back against it. A lot of companies are packing up. Vladimir Putin and his cabinet warned the leaders of a lot of these multinational companies leaving Russia that prosecutors could arrest corporate leaders who criticize the government and seize their assets. So you think about, Starbucks and McDonald's and all these other companies that said, hey, we're not going to do business here anymore. They're leaving. They said they would even seize their trademarks. I don't know how that's done. I'm not a trademark attorney. I'd be curious to see how that would play out. But I guess they'd continue to do business under those names there. And the Russian people would think it's Starbucks or McDonald's. How this whole thing ends, I don't know. Putin's response to the West delivering arms and possibly even planes to Ukraine, that's unknown. But it's pretty certain he will use nuclear weapons if he's pushed far enough, some believe. So I'm joined today by Alexis Marekchek. She's a research associate for Russia and Eurasia at the Heritage Foundation and joins us today. It's good to have her with us. Alexis, thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Of course. Thanks for having me on, Drew.
So, gosh, I don't even know where to start. Let's start with the no-fly zone. Estonia, their parliament calling for the UN to go ahead and to do that. That's a very different kind of thing than NATO doing it. But why have UN member states, Well, let me rephrase this. I'm trying to think of the best way to put it. What do you think will come from this? Do you think that we will eventually see a no-fly zone? And do you think NATO will get involved? Or do you think it'll just be UN member states that do it?
I think it's probably not very likely that a no-fly zone will be put over Ukraine. And because really this would mean NATO or the United States going to war with Russia, because we'd have to be prepared to be shooting down Russian pilots over Ukraine and having search and rescue on the ground for our own pilots being shot down. And we don't want to get in an active war with Russia. And so that's why so many people are saying, no, we should not do a no-fly zone. No, we shouldn't do it. Even though, yes, in theory, it sounds great. And it would be used for humanitarian purposes and, you know, trying to protect citizens fleeing Ukraine for safety. But I don't think personally that it's very likely that the no-fly zone will go through, mm-hmm. even though Estonia is calling for it.
You know, let me just ask you a question about it, because again, I'm not a general in the Army either. I don't have all the intelligence that our military does, but Vladimir Putin's troops have met fierce resistance, right? He's calling to China for military aid and for economic aid. The last thing, if I was Vladimir Putin, that I would want is to have to go toe-to-toe with the United States of America and its NATO allies. I think he's making a lot of threats. I think that's the last thing that he would want. Do you really think that he would react if we did set up a no-fly zone or were a little more aggressive about supplying aid like jets to the country of Ukraine? How far do you think Vladimir will go, and what do you know about who he is and, you know, how he might respond?
Yeah, I think Vladimir Putin is getting really desperate in this situation, because a lot of people think that this war was supposed to last only a couple of days. And now we see it in its third week, which is crazy. And I think the military logistics of the Russian military have not gone to plan. I think that Russia did not plan as well as it should have for, you know, mm-hmm. as well as it wanted to be in Ukraine. I think this is all pointing to Putin's just getting desperate, and he's saying, China, please help us with military assistance. And this is a big deal, because Russia and China don't have the best relationship. So he's seeing this. But I think if a no-fly zone was put over Ukraine, Putin would feel threatened and would potentially be more aggressive, because, you know, we'd probably be shooting down Russian pilots in Ukrainian airspace. So this would be an active conflict. It's hard to say exactly how far Putin would be willing to go, but I do think that he has been showing signs that he's potentially mentally ill. You know, in his speeches that are being broadcast online, his body language is different. He's leaning forward. His eyes are more intense. His tone is more harsh. And so I think that we can't rule anything out, but it does show him getting closer with China now, just how desperate he is in this situation.
So let's talk about China for a moment as well. I know you're an expert on Eurasian affairs there. China has been quiet through most of this. We know Vladimir Putin allowed, you know, consulted with them, told him he was going to do this, waited after the Olympics were over. China, I'm sure, is observing this quite carefully. Where do they stand on all this? I'm sure this is drug out a lot further. Hey, if you think he's going to go in there in 48 hours, take over Kyiv, great. And then it's done. This has gone on now 3 weeks plus, and we're seeing war crimes being perpetrated, civilians being bombed. Ukraine was a sovereign nation. The philosophy of China, they respect sovereign borders. How is this sitting with China, and where would they settle if this thing became a bigger conflict?
It seems that China, I would say, is seriously considering helping Russia in this situation. I think the news still has to come out about whether China will for sure help Russia or not in this situation. But I think they're observing how the West is responding to this war in Ukraine. They're observing how Russia is involved. Of course, you know, they're seeing how strong the West is coming in support of Ukraine, because if China were to try to take over Taiwan in the future, they would want to, you know, have something to go fall back on and, you know, compare to and see, oh, well, would the West, you know, try to get in a conflict with us if we try to take over Taiwan? And and these kinds of things. But I'm no China expert, but I think that China could potentially become much more involved, but we'll just have to see in the coming days.
So maybe you can explain this to me, because I was struck by the fact that Vladimir Putin's talking about the possible seizure of foreign assets. And I understand that, these major companies are leaving Russia, cell phone companies, Apple, I mean, you name it, right? And they're threatening now to seize the assets of those companies that withdraw, and this is reported in the Wall Street Journal, even seize their trademarks. What does that mean? Does that mean, hey, we're gonna seize your Starbucks, your McDonald's, your places, and yet we're going to continue to do business under that particular trademark? So our people think, hey, everything is status quo. How does that work, and what kind of legal ramifications are there with something like that?
Yeah, well, I'm no business or legal expert, but I did see that article as well this morning, and I thought that was really interesting because so many Western companies, as you mentioned, have been pulling out in recent weeks, almost all of them, to be honest. I think just a few remain there, like Microsoft, Oracle, Pfizer says it has to be there because if it pulled out, its patients would be at risk. But Pfizer did announce that all the proceeds from its sales in Russia would be going directly to support Ukraine. So that's really good news and a good compromise. But yeah, Putin has been threatening, just as of today, these companies that are still left in Russia. I don't know exactly how the trademark stuff would work, but I think it puts these businesses in a very scary situation, and it probably is making it hard for them to decide, well, should we pull out, should we not? Because, you know, now they could be punished if they do pull out, but, you know, it's also probably not great that they're still there. I don't really know what these companies will choose to do, but I think Putin, this is another just sign of Putin's desperation, and he's trying to hold control of his country as much as possible.
Well, Alexis, I want to thank you for your time. Thanks for the insight. We'll continue to monitor what's happening here. And my takeaway from our conversation is you don't think Vladimir Putin is a well man. That, to me, is the most disturbing of all the comments and what we're seeing, because that's a case. There's no limit to how far he can go. Thanks for being here with us. We'll continue to take a look at this and more. Thank you, Alexis. Have a great one.
Of course.
One.
Yes, thank you. You too. Bye.
You can check Alexis out at the Heritage Foundation. That's heritage.org. She is an associate, research associate for Russia and Eurasia. When we come back, I want to tell you a little bit about some witches and what they're doing in Moscow. Don't go away. This hour, sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Prices start at $384 a month for families. Check now. See how much you can save. Go to CatholicHealthShare.com.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Coming up here in a few moments, I'll share with you a little bit about a report I saw regarding witches in Moscow and what they're doing to aid Vladimir Putin's efforts. It's a bizarre story. But right now, great bumper, Maggie. I love that rejoin. It's a rich man's world. Let's talk about cash for a second here. I used to be such a huge advocate of going cashless because I never have cash on me. Everything is, you know, ATM or Apple Pay, or, you know, you can use your phone now to pay. It's kind of cool. I think that's going to be the future. But kind of a sobering reality for me recently was these images I've seen coming out of Russia and Ukraine, this war, where people in both countries are lining up at these ATMs to withdraw cash. And Ukrainians are doing it, of course, because their electrical grid has been blown to smithereens by Russia, right? The Russians are doing it apparently because they don't know if Vladimir Putin is going to declare martial law, put limits on how much cash you can take out of your account. And people want their money. They want to be able to buy that loaf of bread or to get what they need to survive. And one bank right now is already in danger of collapse. People are demanding so much money. There's been such a run on it. The other reason Russians are getting cash out is because MasterCard and Visa they've stopped doing business in the country. We just talked about that, right? We talked about Starbucks and McDonald's and all these other companies that are there. MasterCard, Visa, Apple, all these companies, they're not doing business in the country. So that means Russians can't use their credit cards. Apple and Google both have suspended their pay systems, too. So people can't access their bank accounts by using their phones. I mean, the noose is tightening. The grip is tightening. So you saw this happen in Canada as well. Remember the trucker, the protests that were up there just a couple of weeks ago? The Canadian government, they hacked that fundraising site, GiveSendGo. They got the names of the contributors. They froze their bank accounts. Then after look, just to put this in perspective, even if they only contributed a little bit of money, even if they only contributed, let's say, $50, their bank accounts were frozen, right? Their names were garnered. After the protest ended, the government continued to threaten people, saying they were going to, you know, go through the video, identify people they saw there, seek them out for arrest, for financial punishment. And again, this was supposedly a peaceful protest. People saying, hey, we don't like the mandates and we're in support of the truckers. But look at how the government came down on them. Not being able to access your financial accounts. You work hard for your money, right? You work hard for what you have. You want to have access to it. You want it to support you in time of need. Imagine if this, somehow your credit card or your debit cards were shut off. How do you get your money? If you don't have cash, if you don't have the legal tender of the U.S. here, how do you buy? How do you sell? These scenarios where private companies and governments are making it impossible for people to get their money makes you wonder about the idea of transitioning to a cashless society. Is it a good idea? I don't know. Feel free to join me. We'll talk about it. King Banyan joins me. He's dean of the School of Public Affairs at St. Cloud State University and an economics professor there as well. He's also a senior policy fellow of the Center of the American Experiment in Minneapolis. It's good to have him here with us as well. I believe he also served a term as a Minnesota State Representative. So it's good to have you with us today. Appreciate your time and your expertise, King.
Yeah, thank you, Drew. Glad to be here with you.
Yeah, and you're the expert here. I'd love you to walk me through a lot of this. We've seen two major countries cut off access to people's money, one through, of course, private enterprise and the other through the government. Your sense of, you know, how reliant we should be on these electronic means of financial transactions. I personally love them. Never thought we'd see this happen. But there is a certain vulnerability, isn't there?
There certainly is. So suppose, let's take the Canada case to start with, because maybe your listeners are more familiar with it, in which if you were protesting the government's actions, you were basically cut off. Put in digital jail and told that you can't access your bank accounts. Now I'm a happily married man of 30 plus years. Mm-hmm. Suppose my wife had decided or somehow had just given money while she was at home, while I'm at work. She gives money to help a Canadian trucker somewhere. And as a result of that, if I lived in Canada, because I live in the United States, it couldn't happen. But if I was in Canada, suppose it turns out that the bank account's frozen at the end of the day. That's right. Not just her bank account. That's mine. Or suppose I've got a child, you know, who I'm taking care of in college, right? Or who I'm running a trust for, who's perhaps in a hospital or somehow under my guardianship. How do I provide for that? Digital jail is really kind of shocking to people, and I think that was something that as you look at it. I really do think that the Canadians made a mistake. I think they realized it fairly quickly. I don't want to be too harsh to them because I think they figured out fairly quickly, whoops, that might have been a step too far, and they backed off it. But it is a reminder to us that cash depends on trust. And it's not just trust in the person you're trading with, but it's trust in the government that you're allowing to operate the financial system that you work under.
Digital jail, such a great description, too. I love the way you say that. In terms of cash, like I never have it on me. I almost feel bad. You know, I was coming out of a store the other day, and there was a woman there who was collecting money for battered women. And I said, well, can you take a debit or a credit card, something to swipe? She didn't have it. I said, you really should get that. You know, because I didn't have cash. I really wanted to be able to help. The complaint about cash, of course, it can be stolen. You can't trace it back to its owner. There are some places, and I don't know if this is even legal in this country, who don't take cash sometimes. You know, it's a legal tender here. But I know some people, there was a store or two that wouldn't take it. How different is that from your bank account or credit card being hacked, you know, in terms of the use of cash versus credit? And then, you know, I don't know if you have any data on where we are in terms of cash. I mean, how many Americans use cash versus credit today? I'm assuming the numbers are predominantly in favor of ATM, debit, auto payments. Everything is digital today.
Sure. Most of the transactions that happen in the United States do not involve using greenbacks or cash. And most of them don't even include the use of credit of writing a check physically to the purchaser. You might use a card, and then you extinguish your card debt by paying the bank that provides you your credit card service, or you know, American Express, or wherever your bank, whatever bank you have that uses MasterCard or Visa, you pay them at the end of the month. Most of the transactions are happening that way. Most of the cash in the United States, most of our currency, is in fact held by foreigners because they view it as different than just for transactions. They view it as a store of value. All right, I take my dollars and I put them in the mattress because I believe when push comes to shove, those dollars will still be valuable to somebody in return for something I really need in a pinch, which is, I think, the story that you were referring to as you looked at Ukraine and Russia, where I don't think they're going to the bank to get rubles or hryvnia. I think they're going to get dollars or euro or something that they believe will store value and that they will, in fact, put in the mattress or put in their purse and hold on to it, whether or not they're staying in the country or whether they're packing it as they prepare to leave the country.
Yeah, that ruble's worth half a cent right now. I mean, it's worth less than a penny. So it's like I'm totally with you. It makes you wonder, you know, should you have gold? Should you have silver? Should you have something else in times of trial? I also think about cyber attacks. You know, we're here if Vladimir Putin decides not to use nuclear weapons, but really wants to cripple the United States in retaliation. You know, not only could he hit, let's assume he was capable of taking down a power grid or, you know, taking us offline somehow, attacking financial or bank institutions. How would you be able to buy or sell? Would you even be able to buy or sell? If I wanted to go and get some bread or some canned goods or some water or whatever it might be, bandages, I don't know if the store could even process my stuff. Everything is based on electricity, and they'd still have to do that whether I had currency or not. What would you do or what happens? What's the best security blanket, if you would, in terms of currency? I mean, should you have something in case of emergency, and what would that be, and what would happen if something happened in terms of our power grid? Would people be more willing to take cash and say, hey, here's a 20, don't worry about it, I know you don't have change, but let's still give you your can of soup, you know? I mean, how do you see that playing out, if you get my point? I know I'm rambling here.
Yeah, well, I was just overseas this past week. I was in Denmark, and in Denmark, electronic transactions are very, very well, very, very well established. I would say more than the United States, so that people simply don't walk around with Danish currency. They walk around with a card, and it's attached to it. But what happens when the card? So I went to one place, and their card machine didn't work. Right. And I said, so how do I pay you? We have kroner, right? I said, no, I don't. I've learned over the last few days, I don't need them. So I don't have any in my pocket. I have dollars and I have euro. What would you like? Right. So the point is the in this case, restaurant where I had just had dinner is now stuck with, okay, so this guy can't pay me. So what am I going to, he doesn't have kroner. So what do I do? And in this case, he chose to accept a foreign currency. But as I understood it, this was not normal for them. So in a not normal time, the question turns out to be, what is it that the both parties will trust that they understand the value of?
Right.
And you know, if you go back two centuries or three centuries when we really didn't have paper currency at all, or we had paper currency that we viewed as not being worth the paper it was printed on, we would have trusted gold. We would have trusted silver. We would have had some understanding of what it's worth. But how many of us know offhand the price of an ounce of gold anymore?
Yeah.
How many of us know the price of an ounce of silver? We don't. Yeah. So the question gets down to, Drew, simply who do you trust? You know, what do you trust as being able to conduct transactions across a variety of people? Because otherwise, we're stuck writing each other IOUs, and it's you standing behind that promising to pay them some good in return for some other good. Right. That's a barter economy, and those are usually pretty poor.
It's such a great example you put out. When I travel overseas, you know, I used to always exchange currency. Anymore, I just love using your credit card. I mean, the conversion's automatically done. You don't need a whole lot of currency on you. But in a situation like that, how awkward? You know, how do you pay your bill? What do you do? What if you didn't have a euro on you or U.S. dollar? It'd be a very weird situation.
Yeah, I was mortified, right? I can't pay for my dinner. My gosh, right? But at the same time, right, you're mortified by that. But at the same time, you realize that you have options. Now, if you think about people who are of modest means, they may not have had those options. I can only imagine what would have happened in that situation. Yeah. Thankfully, the Danish are just exceedingly nice people and quickly worked with us to figure out what a mutually agreeable solution was.
So in terms of currency, what do you see for the future? I would argue we're probably going to go more digital. I mean, already, I love the technology. Honestly, I love being able to pay with my phone or to put everything on a debit. Or I get frustrated if I have to pay a bill and write a check anymore. It's because I love going online and paying it or having it automatically taken out of the checking account. You know, everything's automated. I remember the days I'd sit down and write a ton of checks. It's history. Are we moving towards a digital currency? And will we at some point in time see some sort of universal digital currency?
Well, we've long had dreams of having a universal currency, be it physical or electronic, because nobody likes to have exchange rates to think about. I mean, I'm looking at a price in kroner and having to translate it into dollars while I'm figuring out what my dinner is going to cost me tonight. So we all like that. Will it be so? Would we all like a universal currency? We do, but universal currency means that you have to have governments coordinate on what that currency does and how it's served, and there's lots of laws to change. So will that ever happen? I'm skeptical on that. I think we'll always have national currencies, except for gold, and physical gold won't be carried, I don't think, and so forth. Will it be digital? I think yes, because as more of our transactions are able to be held in small amounts with people further and further away from us, where maybe someone in India is actually doing something. I actually did this once where I had somebody who turned out to be in India design some presentation slides for me for a talk I was giving, and then I paid them electronically over the internet a few dollars for that action. That is where I think the wave of that future is, Drew. I think it's going to be digital, but I question whether or not we'll actually ever have a universal currency.
Well, I'll tell you, I'd take a short pause. Stay with me for a few more minutes if you could, because I'd love to get your take on crypto. In light of the runs on banks and the ability for Canada to seize people's assets, you can see how a digital currency like Bitcoin or some other might become more attractive. We'll take a look at that tomorrow. I'm going to explore this concept of the Great Reset. Is it a reality? What do we know about it? We can talk about that more. If you want to join us, I only have Representative Banya with me for a short time. You can dial in 888-914-9149.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Why don't they do what they say? Say what you mean. One thing leads to another. Me something wrong, I know.
Yeah, great to be here with you today. Thank you for joining us. If you're just tuned in, I am speaking today with an economics professor, the dean of the School of Public Affairs at St. Cloud State University, Representative King Banyan. He served a term as a Minnesota state representative, and we're here today just taking a look at the future of cash and whether or not we are marching towards a cashless society. I would argue we probably are going to transition to that. And it raises questions for me as I see possible runs on banks, as we see what happened in Canada with bank accounts being seized. And Representative Banyan pointed out, you know, imagine if my wife made a contribution and my accounts got locked up because we have joint accounts. I mean, how does this all play out? A lot of people have used Bitcoin and digital currencies to do transactions so they cannot be tracked. A lot of times there's nefarious actions behind that. But there is a greater recognition of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies today. You've seen a number of ads, even at the Super Bowl, promoting that now. So it's becoming more mainstream. Representative Bennett, what's your take on a big picture? We don't have to drill into the nuances of cryptocurrency, but you know, I had heard that the government, I think the Biden administration, wanted to look at either creating a U.S. coin of some sort, digital coin, or taking a look at how to better track and deal with that. What about cryptocurrency? And we talk about cashless societies. You know, ones and zeros running things through banks are one thing. What about crypto and blockchain technology? Is that part of that cashless society, that future?
Well, it can be, and there's a variety of things you've got in that question, Drew. I mean, one of them is whether or not it's going to be provided by the government, like a central bank digital currency, digital coin that's been discussed by the Federal Reserve, but they've said it has to be enacted by Congress. So that'd be on one side. Bitcoin is intentionally made to be distributed across a network, and so that there are lots of different places that show that you have so much in Bitcoin, and its distribution is part of its strength. The weakness of it is actually just that it's hard for you to figure out how do you actually hold a digital coin. How do you hold a Bitcoin? And that's what's different about this, because we allow our checking accounts and savings accounts to be physically held by somebody else, and it turns out a government could step in through an Emergencies Act, like in Canada, and mm-hmm. keep you from accessing it.
Yeah,
well, sure. if your digital coin run by the central bank is actually known to the government and known to your financial institution, they could freeze you out of that too. So it really doesn't save anything. I mean, the whole value of gold was that you actually had physical control of it. The value of the dollar, right? My reaction was when I couldn't pay the bill at the Danish restaurant was to reach into my wallet, grab a piece right. of paper and say, hey, I have this. And then I have to find out, will you accept it? Right? And if they don't, we still have to figure out how dinner's going to be paid for.
Give me your watch.
And I mean, I had my iWatch on, and, right. and who knows? It may have come to that. It wasn't that
that's,
big
that's
a dinner.
Funny. No, I know. Yeah, let's take a phone call. We have a few moments here, and I appreciate your sense of humor and your expertise too. It's great to have you here. I'm enjoying our conversation. Margaret is listening in San Diego, California. Margaret, good afternoon. You are on the air.
Well, good afternoon, Drew. I'm calling to ask what your take is on the possibility of a digital currency going towards the social credit system China has.
Such a great question.
That's a super question.
So you're familiar with social credit scoring then. No, God, I'll let you handle it.
Yeah, so social credit, a social credit system is simply a way by which the government determines whether or not you're credit worthy based on your social behaviors. Mm-hmm. In China, that's a very big thing. And you could imagine that a little bit of that, you were doing something socially really, really bad, according to the Trudeau government in Canada, so we're going to cut that off. I'm not as concerned about that in the United States, because I do believe our Constitution would provide some strong objections and strong protections against a social credit system like that. But it happened in Canada, and yeah, I'd say I have a little less faith in my belief than I had maybe 2 months ago.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with Black Mirror. It was a series that ran on Netflix for a while. They did a great piece on social credit scoring. One of the episodes was on that, and it's quite amazing. And this is actually true, too. I mean, there are reports of people whose parents who have a bad social credit score in China, their kids can't go to certain universities. You can't travel. You can't leave the country. I mean, it's ridiculous. So imagine if everything was controlled by the government and your digital currency can be turned on or off, or, you know, you'd be charged much higher interest rates or whatever. It would have a profound economic impact. Margaret, thank you for your question. It's good to have you. You don't see social credit scoring coming to this country, do you, Professor?
I do not. I'm a pretty conservative fellow, and I have views about whether or not the government has encroached on our civil liberties. I think they have to some extent, but that is such a further piece down the road. I have to think that we're still, I'd like to believe, even a few decades away from anything like that if we continue our current path. But it's an argument for why we shouldn't continue on the current path.
Well, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it. Appreciate your service to the country and to your school. People want to get in touch with you or you're the institution. What's the best way to connect?
Well, they can find me at my school at stcloudstate.edu/SOPA for the School of Public Affairs here at St. Cloud State.
Sounds great. Thank you very much for being here. Always good to have you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. A great day.
It's King Banyan, and I only have a moment or two left, and we'll see what the future holds. I'm always fascinated by this conversation on digital currency and where it leads. I love it. I lean towards it, but I love the representative's story about what happened to him when he couldn't pay for dinner. What happens when technology goes down? How do you remedy those situations? Some serious stuff. Hey, before we stop and pray the chaplet coming up here in about 4 minutes, let me fill you in on what's happening here over in Moscow regarding these witches who are supporting Vladimir Putin. And as I've said this many, many times, you know, I quoted St. James last week. A lot of this is deeply rooted in the spiritual. Right now, reports are coming out that witches are gathering in Moscow. They are supporting the Russian president in his war right now on Ukraine. And they're performing these demonic, these occult rituals for the so-called good of Russia. They say that as Russian citizens, you know, they don't have the right to criticize those who govern, which is kind of wacky. But Asia News was reporting, they said, those who hear do not hear, those who see but do not see, those who are there, were there, and will be there, will not forget my word. Raise the strength of Russia, direct our president on the path of justice. And they go through this long invocation where these witches, the founder of the Great Witches of Russia Association, they held a general council of witches in support of Putin on the evening of the 12th of March. So just a day or two ago. And I don't want to go through, I don't want to read their incantation. I don't want to do any of these things. But there were about 100 or so women who were dedicated to these dark arts, dressed in habits and hoods, and they were decorated with all these images of birds of prey. And they gathered in a spirit of solidarity for what Vladimir Putin is doing. But what's he doing? He's committing war crimes. He's striking maternity wards. I just shared with you a few moments ago how about that pregnant mother who had her hip broken and dislocated as a result of the bomb blast, had an emergency C-section. Her baby was dead, and she died on the operating table. According to the witches, they want to help speed up these events. They want to put him, they want to protect him from danger, from his enemies. And I just, you know, when I see the Church of Satan get behind abortion, when I see witches conjuring to help the efforts of somebody like Vladimir Putin, and we see the horrors of what's unfolding, you talk about Satan no longer hiding in the shadows, right? No longer wanting to be invisible. But I think he's coming out, and you can see clearly his manifestation there. He's becoming more aggressive than ever. And what's the solution to this? It is prayer, and it is fasting, it is penance, and it is sacrifice. Angel of Fatima cried out with its flaming sword in that third secret, penance, penance, penance. Offer your sacrifices, pray for peace. Join me for the Chapel of Divine Mercy. We're going to pray it right now in about a minute. And if you have a special need, want, or intention, feel free to join me. Let's pray for peace in the world. Let's pray for those who are involved in the occult, those who've lost their ways. Right now, these witches are conjuring special curses against the enemies of Vladimir Putin and Russia. So that means NATO, means the United States, it means our leaders. They're shouting these curses. And this is real stuff. In fact, there was an exorcist, and maybe I'll be able to talk about this a little later in the week with you, who really believes there's more to this picture spiritually than meets the eye.